Mr. Slopes? Snowy Slopes gingerly felt his neck, or at least the neck of his soul. The human soul tends to keep the shape of the original body for some time after death. Habit is a wonderful thing.
Who the hell was he?
He said. Not someone you know, said Death.
Well, no. I don't know many people who cut my head off.
Snowy Slopes' body had knocked against the table as it fell. Several bottles of medicated shampoo now dripped and mixed their contents onto the other more intimate fluids from the Slopes' corpse.
That stuff with the special oil in it cost me nearly $4,
said Snowy. Yet somehow it all seemed slightly irrelevant now. Death happens to other people. The other person in this case had been him. That is, the one down there, not the one standing here looking at it. In life, Snowy hadn't even been able to spell metaphysical, but he was already beginning to view life in a different way. From the outside, for a start.
$4, he repeated. I never even had time to try it.
It wouldn't have worked, said Death, patting the man on a fading shoulder. But if I might suggest that you look on the bright side, it will no longer be necessary.
No more dandruff, said Snowy, now quite transparent and fading fast.
Ever, said Death. Trust me on this. Commander Vimes ran down the darkened streets, trying to buckle on his breastplate as he ran. All right, Cheery, what's happening?
They say a Clatchian killed someone, sir. There's a mob up in Scandal Alley, and it's looking bad. I was on the desk, and I thought you ought to be told, sir.
Right.
And anyway, I couldn't find Captain Carrot, sir.
A little bit of acid ink scribbled its subtle entry on the ledger of Vimes' soul.
Oh, gods. So who's the officer in charge?
Sergeant Detritus, sir.
It seemed to the dwarf that she was suddenly standing still. Commander Vimes had become a rapidly disappearing blur. With the calm expression of someone who was methodically doing his duty, Detritus picked up a man and used him to hit some other men. When he had a clear area around him and a groaning heap of former rioters, he climbed the heap and cupped his hands around his mouth.
Listen to me, ye people!
A troll shouting at the top of his voice could easily be heard above a riot. When he seemed to have their attention, he pulled a scroll out of his breastplate and waved it over his head.
This is the Riot Act, he said. You know what that means? It means if an I reads it out and you don't go away, the watch can use deadly force. You understand?
What did you just use then?
Moaned someone from underneath his feet.
That was you helping the watch, said Detritus, shifting his weight.
He unrolled the scroll. Although there was some scuffling in alleyways and shouts from the next street, a ring of silence expanded outwards from the troll. An almost genetic component of the citizens of Ankh-Morpork was their ability to spot an opportunity for amusement. Detritus held the document at arm's length, and then, a few inches from his face, he tried turning it round a few times. His lips moved unsteadily. Finally, he leaned down and showed it to Constable Visit.
What's this word?
That's whereby, Sergeant.
I knew that.
He straightened up again.
Whereby it is.
Beads of the troll equivalent of sweat began to form on Detritus's forehead.
Whereby it is acknowledged.
Acknowledged.
Whispered Constable Visit.
I knew that.
Detritus stared at the paper again and then gave up.
You don't want to stand here listening to me all day, he bellowed. This is the Riot Act and you've all got to read it, right? Pass it round.
What if we don't read it?
Said a voice in the crowd.
You've got to read it. It's legal.
And then what happens?
Then I shoot you,
said Detritus.
That's not allowed, said another voice. You've got to shout, stop, armed watchman, first.
Sure, that suits me,
said Detritus. He shrugged one huge shoulder to bring his crossbow under his arm. It was a siege bow, intended to be mounted on the cart. The bolt was 6 feet long.
It's harder to hit running targets.
He released the safety catch.
Anyone finishing reading that thing yet?
Sergeant!
Vimes pushed his way through the crowd, And it was a crowd now. Ankh-Morpork was always a good audience. There was a clang as Detritus saluted.
"Were you proposing to shoot these people in cold blood, Sergeant?"
"No, sir. Just a warning shot in the head, sir."
"Really? Just give me a moment to talk to them, then."
Vimes looked at the man next to him. He was holding a flaming torch in one hand and a long length of wood in the other. He gave Vimes the nervously defiant stare of someone who has just felt the ground shift under his feet. Vimes pulled the torch towards him and lit a cigar.
"What's happening here, friend?"
"The Clatchians have been shooting people, Mr. Vimes. Unprovoked attack."
"Really?
People have been killed."
"Who?"
Everyone knows they've been killing people."
The man's mental footsteps found safer ground.
"What do they think they are? Coming over here."
"That's enough," said Vimes.
He stood back and raised his voice.
"I recognise a lot of you," he said, "and I know you've got homes to go to. See this?"
He pulled his baton of office out of his pocket.
"This says I've got to keep the peace. So in 10 seconds I'm going somewhere else to find some peace to keep. But Detritus is going to stay here. And I just hope he doesn't do anything to disgrace the uniform. Or get it very dirty, at least."
Irony was not a degree-level subject among the listeners, but the brighter ones recognised Vimes' expression. It said that here was a man hanging on to his patience by his teeth. The mob dispersed, going ragged at the edges as people legged it down side alleys, threw away their makeshift weapons, and emerged at the other end, walking the grave, thoughtful walk of honest citizens.
"All right, what happened?" said Vimes, turning to the troll.
"We're hearing where this boy shot this man," said Detritus. "We got here. Next minute it's raining people from everywhere shouting."
"He smote him, as Hudrun smote the fleshpots of Ur,"
said Constable Visit. Constable Visit the Ungodly with explanatory pamphlets was a good copper, Vimes always said, and that was his highest term of praise. He was an omnian with his countrymen's almost pathological interest in evangelical religion, and spent all his wages on pamphlets. He even had his own printing press. The results were handed out to anyone interested, and everyone who wasn't interested as well. Even Detritus couldn't clear a crowd faster than Visit, Vimes said. And on his days off, he could be seen tramping the streets with his colleague, Smite the Unbeliever with cunning arguments. So far, they hadn't made a single convert. Vimes thought that Visit was probably a really nice man underneath it all, but somehow he could never face the task of finding out.
"Smote," said Vimes, bewildered. "He killed someone."
"Not by the way the man was cussing, sir," said Detritus. "Hit him in the arm. His friends brought him round the watch house to complain. He's a baker on the night shift. He said he was late for work. He come running in to pick up his dinner. Next minute, he's flat on the floor."
Vimes walked across the street and tried the door of the shop. It opened a little way and then fetched up against what seemed to be a barricade. Furniture had been piled up against the window as well.
"How many people were there, Constable?" "A multitude thereof, sir."
"And 4 people in here," thought Vimes. "A family." The door moved a fraction, and Vimes realized he was ducking even before the crossbow protruded. There was the thung of the string. The bolt tumbled rather than sped. It corkscrewed wildly across the alley and was almost moving sideways when it hit the opposite wall.
"Look," said Vimes, keeping his body down but raising his voice. "Anyone who got hit with that, it must have been an accident. This is the watch. Open the door, otherwise Detritus will open it. And when he opens the door, it stays open. You know what I mean?"
There was no reply.
"All right. Detritus, just step over here."
There was a hissed argument inside, and then the sound of scraping as furniture was moved. He tried the door. It swung inwards. The family were at the far end of the room. Vimes felt 8 eyes on him. The atmosphere had a hot, worrying feel, spiced with the smell of burnt food. Mr. Goriff was holding the crossbow gingerly, and the expression on his son's face told Vimes a lot of what he needed to know.
"All right," he said. "Now you all listen to me. I'm not arresting anyone right now, you hear? This sounds like one of those things that make his lordship yawn. But you'd do better spending the rest of the night in the watch house. I can't spare the men to stand guard here. Do you understand? I could arrest you, but this is just a request."
Mr. Goriff cleared his throat.
"The man I shot,"
he began, and left the question and the lie hanging in the air. Vimes forced himself not to glance at the boy.
"Not badly hurt," he said.
"He ran in," said Mr. Goriff, "and after last night..."
You thought you were being attacked again and grabbed the crossbow.
Yes, said the boy defiantly before his father could speak.
There was a brief argument in Clatchian. Then Mr. Goriff said,
We must leave the house.
For your own good. We'll try to have someone watch it. Now get something together and go off with the sergeant. And give me that crossbow.
Goriff handed it over with a look of relief. It was a typical Saturday night special, so badly made and erratic that the only safe place to be when it was fired would be directly behind it. And even then you would be running a risk. And then no one had told its owner that under the counter, in a steamy shop and a perpetual rain of grease, wasn't the best place to keep it strung. The string sagged. Probably the only way you could reliably hurt someone with it was to beat them over the head. Vimes waited until they'd been ushered out and took a last look around the room. It wasn't large. In the kitchen behind the shop, something spicy in a pot was boiling dry. After burning his fingers a couple of times, he managed to tip the pot onto the fire to put it out, and then, vaguely remembering his mother doing something like this, put the pot under the pump to soak. Then he barricaded the windows as best he could and went out, locking the door behind him. A discreetly obvious brass Thieves Guild plaque over the door told the world that Mr. Goriff had conscientiously paid his annual fee and would not therefore be officially burgled. Ankh-Morpork had a very direct approach to the idea of insurance. When the middleman was cut out, that wasn't a figure of speech. But the world had plenty of less formal dangers, and so Vimes took a piece of chalk out of his pocket and wrote on the door, Under the protection of the watch. As an afterthought, he signed it, Sergeant Detritus. In the imaginations of the less civically minded, the majesty of the rule of law didn't carry anything like as much weight as the dread of Detritus. The Riot Act. Where the hell had he dredged that from? Carrot, probably. It hadn't been used for as long as Vimes could remember, and that was no wonder when you knew what it really did. Even Vetinari would hesitate to use it. Now it was nothing more than a phrase. Thank goodness for trollish illiteracy. It was when Vimes stood back to admire his handiwork that he saw the glow in the sky over Park Lane almost at the same time as he heard the clatter of iron boots on the street.
Oh, hello, little bottom, he said. What now? Don't tell me. Someone set fire to the Clatchian embassy.
All right, sir, said the dwarf.
She stood uncertainly in the middle of the alley, looking worried.
Well, said Vimes.
You said...
With a sinking feeling, Vimes remembered that the generic dwarfish skill with iron was matched only by the fumble-fingered grasp of irony.
The Clatchian embassy is really on fire.
Yes, sir.
Mrs. Spent opened the door a crack.
Yes?
I'm a friend of... Carrot hesitated, wondering if Fred would have given his real name.
Big fat man, suit doesn't fit. The one who goes around with the sex maniac?
Pardon?
Skinny little twerp dresses like a clown?
They said you'd have a room, said Carrot desperately.
They've got it, said Mrs. Spent, trying to shut the door.
They said I could use it.
No subletting.
They said I should pay you $2.
The pressure of the door was released a little.
On top of what they paid?
Said Mrs. Spent.
Of course. Well,
she looked Carrot up and down and sniffed.
All right. What shift are you on?
Sorry?
You're a watchman, right?
Carrot hesitated and then raised his voice. No, I am not a watchman.
Ha, 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 ha! You think I'm a watchman? Do I look like a watchman? Yes, you do, said Mrs. Spent. You're Captain Carrot. I've seen you walking about the town. Still, I suppose even coppers have to sleep somewhere.
On the roof, Angua rolled her eyes.
No women, no cooking, no music, no pets, said Mrs. Spent as she led the way up the creaking stairs.
Angua waited in the dark until she heard the window open.
She's gone, Carrot hissed. There's glass on the tiles out here, just like Fred reported, said Angua, as she swung herself over the sill.
Inside the room, she took a deep breath and shut her eyes. First, she had to forget the smell of carrot, anxious sweat, soap, the lingering hints of armour polish. And Fred Colon, all perspiration with a hint of beer, and then the odd ointment Nobby used for his skin condition, and the smells of feet, bodies, clothes, polish, fingernails. After an hour, it was possible for the eye of the nose to see someone walk across the room, frozen in time by their smell. But after a day, smells crisscrossed and entangled. You had to take them apart, remove the familiar pieces. And what you had left...
Oh, they're so mixed up.
All right, said Carrot soothingly. At least three people, but I think one of them is Ossie. It's stronger round the bed, and... She opened her eyes wide and looked down at the floor. Somewhere here.
What? What is?
Angua crouched down with her nose just above the floorboards.
I can smell it, but I can't see it.
A knife appeared in front of her. Carrot got down on his knees and ran the blade along the dust-filled crack between the floorboards. Something splintery and brown popped up. It had been trodden on and rolled underfoot, but at this distance even Carrot could pick up traces of the clove smell.
Do you think Ossie made a lot of apple pies? He whispered.
No cooking, remember? Said Angua and grinned. There's something else. Carrot levered out more dirt and dust. In it, something glittered.
Fred said all the glass was outside, didn't he?
Yes. Well, supposing we assume that someone didn't pick up all the bits when they broke in.
For someone that doesn't like lying, Carrot, you can be quite devious, you know.
Just logical. There's glass outside the window, but all that means is that there is glass outside the window. Commander Vimes always says there's no such things as clues. It's how you look at them.
You think someone broke in and then carefully put the glass outside?
Could be.
Carrot, why are we whispering?
No women, remember?
And no pets, said Angua. So she's got me coming and going.
Don't look like that, she added when she saw his face. It's only bad taste if someone else says it. I'm allowed. Carrot scratched up some more glass fragments. Angua looked under the bed and pulled out the battered magazines.
Ye gods, do people really read this stuff? She said, flicking through bows and ammo.
Testing the Loxley Reflex 7, a whole lot of bow. Footsore, we test the 10 best caltrops.
And what's this magazine?
Warrior of Fortune.
There's always little wars somewhere, said Carrot, pulling out the box of money.
But will you look at the size of this axe here? Get a head, get a burly and strong in the arm street sweeper, and win by a neck.
Well, it must be true what they say about men who like big weapons.
And that is, said Carrot, lifting the lid of the box. She looked up at the top of his head. As always, Carrot radiated innocence like a small sun. But
They're rather small, she said.
Oh, that's true, said Carrot, picking up some of the Clatchian coins. Look at dwarfs, never happier than with a chopper the same size as them. And Nobby's fascinated by weapons, and he's practically dwarf-sized.
Technically, Angua was sure she knew Carrot better than anyone else. She was pretty sure he cared a lot for her.
He seldom said so, he just assumed that she knew. She'd known other men, although turning into a wolf for part of the month was one of those little flaws that could put any normal man off, and up until Carrot always had. And she knew the sort of things men said in what might be called the heat of the moment and then forgot. But when Carrot said things, you knew that he felt that everything was now settled until further notice. So if she made any comment, he'd be genuinely surprised that she'd forgotten what it was he had said, and would probably quote date and time. And yet all the time there was this feeling that the greater part of him was always deep, deep inside, looking out. No one could be so simple, no one could be so creatively dumb, without being very intelligent. It was like being an actor. Only a very good actor was any good at being a bad actor.
"Rather a lonely person, our Nobby," said Carrot.
"Well, yes. But I'm sure he'll find the right person for him," Carrot added cheerfully.
"Probably in a bottle," said Angua to herself.
She remembered the conversation with him. It was a terrible thing to think, but there was something itchy about the thought of Nobby being allowed in the gene pool, even at the shallow end.
"You know, these coins are odd," said Carrot.
"How do you mean?" said Angua, grateful for the distraction.
Why would he be paid in Clatchian walls? He wouldn't be able to spend them here, and the money changers don't give very good rates.
Carrot tossed a coin in the air and caught it.
When we were leaving, Mr. Vimes said to me, make sure you find the bunch of dates and the camel hidden under the pillow. I think I know what he meant.
Sand on the floor, said Angua. Now, isn't that an obvious clue? You can tell they were Clatchians because of the sand in their sandals.
But these clothes,
Carrot prodded the little bud. It's not as if it's a common habit, even among Clatchians. That's not a very obvious clue, is it?
It smells newer, said Angua. I'd say he was here last night.
After Ossie was dead?
Yes.
Why?
How should I know? What kind of name is 71-hour Ahmed? Said Angua.
Carrot shrugged. I don't know. I think Mr. Vimes thinks that someone in Ankh-Morpork wants us to believe that Clatchians paid to have the prince killed. That sounds nasty, but logical. But I don't understand why a real Clatchian would get involved.
Their eyes met.
Politics, they said together.
For enough money, a lot of people would do anything, said Angua.
There was a sudden and ferocious knocking at the door.
Have you got someone in there?
Said Mrs. Spent.
Out of the window, said Carrot. Why don't I just stay and rip her throat out? Said Angua.
All right, it was a joke, all right, she said, swinging her legs over the sill. Ankh-Morpork no longer had a fire brigade. The citizens had a rather disturbingly direct way of thinking at times, and it didn't take long for people to see the rather obvious flaw in paying a group of people by the number of fires they put out. The penny really dropped shortly after Charcoal Tuesday. Since then, they had relied on the good old principle of enlightened self-interest. People living close to a burning building did their best to douse the fire, because the thatch they saved might be their own. But the crowd watching the burning embassy were doing so in a hollow-eyed, distant way, as if it was all taking place on some distant planet. They moved aside automatically as Vimes elbowed his way through to the space in front of the gates. Flames were already licking from every ground-floor window, and they could make out scurrying silhouettes in the flickering light. He turned to the crowd.
"Come on, what's up with you? Get a bucket chain going!"
"It's their bloody embassy,"
said a voice.
"Yes, Clatchian soil, right?"
"Can't go on Clatchian soil. That'd be an invasion, that would. They wouldn't let us,"
said a small boy holding a bucket. Vimes looked at the embassy gateway. There were a couple of guards. Their worried glances kept going back from the fire behind them to the crowd in front. They were nervous men, but it was much worse than that, because they were nervous men holding big swords. He advanced on them, trying to smile, and holding his badge out in front of him. It had a shield on it. It was not a very big shield.
"Commander Vimes, Ankh-Morpork City Watch," he said, in what he hoped was a helpful and friendly voice.
A guard waved him away.
"You'll be off."
"Ah," said Vimes. He looked down at the cobbles of the gateway and then back up at the guard. Somewhere in the flames, someone was screaming.
"You, come here. You see this?"
he shouted at the guard, pointing down. The man took a hesitant step forward.
"That's Ankh-Morpork soil down there, my friend," said Vimes, "and you're standing on it and you're obstructing me in my..."
He rammed his fist as hard as he could into the guard's stomach.
"Duty!"
He was already kicking out as the other guard rushed him. He caught him on the knee. Something went click. It felt like Vimes's own ankle. Cursing and limping slightly, he ran on into the embassy and caught a scurrying man by his robe.
"Are there still people in there? Are there people in there?"
The man gave Vimes a panicky look. The armfuls of paper he'd been carrying spilled onto the ground. Someone else grabbed his shoulder.
"Can you climb, Mr. Vimes?"
"Who are you?"
The newcomer turned to the cowering paper carrier and struck him heavily across the face.
"Rescuer of paper?"
As the man fell back, his turban was snatched from his head.
"This way."
The figure plunged off through the smoke. Vimes hurried after him until they reached a wall with a drainpipe attached.
"How did you..."
"Up, up."
Vimes put one foot in the man's cupped hands, managed to get the other one on a bracket and forced himself upwards.
"Hurry."
He managed to half-climb, half-pull himself up the pipe, little fireworks of pain exploding up and down his leg, as he reached a parapet and hauled himself over. The other man rose behind him, as if he'd run up the wall. There was a strip of cloth hiding the lower half of his face. He thrust another strip towards Vimes.
"Across your nose and mouth,"
he commanded,
"for the smoke."
It was boiling across the roof. Beside Vimes, a chimney pot gushed a roaring tongue of flame. The rest of the unwound turban was thrust into his hands.
"You take this side, I'll take the other,"
said the apparition, and darted away again into the smoke.
"But who..."
Vimes could feel the heat through his boots. He edged away across the roof and heard the shouting coming from below. When he leaned over the edge here, he could see the window some way below him. Someone had smashed a pane because a hand was waving. There was more commotion down in the courtyard. Amid a press of figures, he could make out the huge shape of Constable Dorfel, a golem, and quite definitely fireproof.
but Dorfel was bad enough at stairs as it was. There weren't many that could take the weight. The hand in the smoke stopped waving. Vimes looked down again.
"Can you fly, Mr. Vimes?"
He looked at the chimney, belching flame. He looked at the unwound turban. A lot of Sam Vimes's brain had shut down, although the bits relaying the twinges of pain from his legs were operating with distressing efficiency. But there were still some thoughts operating down around the core, and they delivered for his consideration the insight, tough-looking cloth. He looked back at the chimney. It looked stout enough. The window was about 6 feet below. Vimes began to move automatically. So, purely theoretically, if a man were to wrap one end of the cloth round the belching stack like this, and pay it out like this, and lower himself over the parapet like this, and kick himself away from the wall like this, then when he swung back again, his feet ought to be able to smash his way through the other panes of the window like this. A cart squeaked along the wet street. Its progress was erratic, because no two of its wheels were the same size, so it rocked and wobbled and skidded and probably involved more effort to pull than it saved overall, especially since its contents appeared to be rubbish. But then so did its owner, who was about the size of a man, but bent almost double and was covered with hair or rags or quite possibly a matted mixture of both that was so felted and unwashed that small plants had taken root on it. If the thing had stopped walking and crouched down, it would have given an astonishingly good impression of a long-neglected compost heap. As it walked along, it snuffled. A foot was stuck out to impede its progress. "Good evening, Stooley," said Carrot, as the cart halted. The heap stopped. Part of it tilted upwards.
"Get off,"
it muttered from somewhere in the thatch. "Now, now, Stooley, let's help one another, shall we? You help me, and I'll help you."
"Bugger off, Captain."
"Will you tell me things I want to know," said Carrot, "and I won't search your cart."
"I hate gnolls," said Angua. "They smell awful."
"Oh, that's hardly fair. The streets would be a lot dirtier without you and yours, eh, Stooley?" said Carrot, still speaking quite pleasantly. "You pick up this, you pick up that. Maybe bash it against a wall until it stops struggling."
"It's a vile accuracy,"
said the gnoll. There was a bubbling noise that might have been a chuckle. "So I'm hearing you might know where Snowy Slopes is these days," said Carrot.
I don't know, nothing.
Fine. Carrot produced a three-tined garden fork and walked round to the cart, which dripped.
I don't know nothing about,
said the gnoll quickly. "Yes," said Carrot, fork poised.
"Don't know nothing about it in the sweet shop, in Money Trip Lane."
"The one with the rooms to let sign?"
Right.
"Well done. Thank you for being a good citizen," said Carrot. "Incidentally, we passed a dead seagull on the way here. It's in Brewer Street. But if you hurried, you could beat the rush."
"Hut diggity,"
snuffled the gnoll. The cart started to judder forward. The watchman watched it lurch and scrape around the corner. "They're good fellows at heart," said Carrot. "I think it says a lot for the spirit of tolerance in this city that even gnolls can call it home."
"They turn my stomach," said Angua, as they set off again. "That one had plants growing on him."
"Mr. Vimes says we ought to do something for them," said Carrot.
"All heart, that man."
"With a flamethrower, he says."
"Wouldn't work. Too soggy. Has anyone ever really found out what they eat?"
"It's better to think of them as cleaners. You certainly don't see as much rubbish and dead animals on the streets as you used to."
"Yes, but have you ever seen a gnoll with a brush and a shovel?"
"Well, that's society for you, I'm afraid," said Carrot. "Everything is dumped on the people below until you find someone who's prepared to eat it. That's what Mr. Vimes says."
"Yes," said Angua.
They walked in silence for a while, and then she said, "You care a lot about what Mr. Vimes says, don't you? He is a fine officer and an example to us all.
And you've never thought of getting a job in Quirm or somewhere, have you? The other cities are headhunting Ankh-Morpork watchmen now."
"What? Leave Ankh-Morpork?" The tone of voice included the answer.
"No, I suppose not," said Angua sadly.
"Anyway, I don't know what Mr. Vimes would do without me running around all the time."
"It's a point of view, certainly," said Angua.